Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Anxiety and autism could become the next two qualifying conditions for medical marijuana in Ohio. The state medical board last week recommended adding anxiety and autism to the list, but rejected depression, insomnia, and opioid addiction. The full board is expected to vote in June. Dr. Joel Simmons is a radiation oncologist in Columbus and a medical marijuana recommending physician in Ohio. He joins us by phone. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Ann. I appreciate it.
What do you make of anxiety as a qualifying condition for medical marijuana?
Well, I was actually surprised. I was approached to provide letters of support for two of the final five that made the cut, for the opioid use disorder and for autism. But when I looked at the list of five, I was, my initial thoughts were no way that they would consider anxiety. More from political standpoint, I mean, we're talking about, a quarter to a third of the population has an anxiety disorder. So I thought that that was so significant that there'd be no way it made it through. So I'm actually, kind of pleasantly surprised. Mm-hmm. In the clinic, when I'm seeing patients, it's the top three situation and that they're dealing with is anxiety, easily the top three. But I'm just surprised that it got this far.
Well, I'm going to jump ahead a little bit to the question about insomnia then, because a lot of people say that it's anxiety that triggers insomnia.
Well, that's what's really interesting with how they're picking and choosing what a qualifying medical condition is, because there's significant overlap. So I would say the most common, the number one thing anecdotally that I see in the clinic is, folks tell me I have problems with sleep. They've been self-medicating. It helps me sleep. Mm-hmm. So, when you look at anxiety, when you look at PTSD, there's a lot of overlap, a lot of gray area between them, and a lot of the symptoms that people are experiencing, such as insomnia, are involved with both. So we're getting to a point here when we're picking and choosing these conditions and what is a qualifying one and what isn't, where there's a lot of gray and a lot of overlap.
What about autism?
Autism is interesting because the traditional treatments that are available just aren't very effective. The medications aren't very effective. The behavioral therapy isn't very effective. I had kind of an eye-opening experience yesterday with a patient. It was a husband and wife that came to the clinic, and the wife was seeing me for PTSD, and she definitely qualified and had been diagnosed with that, but one of her major triggers of her recurring issues with PTSD was the fact that she's dealing with a child with autism, who's acting out, who's physically abusive, and they've run the gamut of various treatments. So, it was kind of eye-opening for me to see how that impacts the family. We don't have great randomized controlled studies with marijuana, obviously, because of the federal legal status that it has. We don't have the sorry about that. I got an overhead call there. We don't have the research dollars that have been put into it. So a lot of the data is coming from overseas, places like Israel, from more cohort studies, observational studies. But there have been impressive results in terms of helping kids with autism. So it's significant.
Well, autism, by the way, listeners, you're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. And we're talking about a vote coming up in June by the State Medical Board to add perhaps autism and anxiety as qualifying conditions for medical marijuana in Ohio. My guest is Dr. Joel Simmons. He's a radiation oncologist in Columbus and a medical marijuana recommending physician in Ohio. If you have a question or comment about medical marijuana, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. As far as autism goes, we talk about the spectrum, and I'm wondering what is it about autism? I mean, what are we talking about? Because autism's it's a syndrome, isn't it? It's a lot of different conditions.
It is. There's a few different conditions kind of that fall under that spectrum. So, ranging from your kind of traditional autism to things like Asperger's syndrome. Mm-hmm. So there is a spectrum, and kids, some kids are more highly functional than others. So, you know, you have to kind of, if we're going to bring this on board, you have to use some discretion in terms of who is the most appropriate for treatment, whether using CBD-based treatments versus, you know, how much THC is involved and things of that nature.
Mm-hmm. Depression was rejected.
That one didn't surprise me. In the research that I've seen, it's just kind of a mixed bag there. And when you think of marijuana in general, there are some sedating qualities there. So the results from the limited research that we have just aren't as impressive as those from anxiety. So yes. That didn't surprise me at all. I thought that was kind of the first one that would get tossed.
I was a little surprised that opioid addiction was rejected, because what I think of when I think of using THC or CBD in terms of addiction is not to replace the addictive drug, but to help with the withdrawal from addiction.
I agree with you there. That was the one of the five that they narrowed the list down to that I thought was kind of the most appropriate. So that was kind of a shock to me that we didn't get that. I actually had also wrote a letter of support for one of the submissions for opioid use disorder. So, you know, in terms of the data, I think there is great data out there, but it's also not a complete loss, because I think, again, going back to how much overlap we have with these conditions, a lot of the folks who are abusing the opiates and unfortunately started out because of their chronic pain condition.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that kind of still leaves a catch-all there for people to still get qualified.
Because chronic pain is one of the qualifying.
Exactly. I don't think, you know, even though I thought that was a no-brainer in terms of getting that one approved, I think we still have a backdoor, if I may say that, in terms of there's overlap there with the chronic pain population.
Does having the list grow make it easier for you as a recommending physician, or more difficult, or what's your thoughts about that?
I think it's a good thing, because I think we have a lot of people out there who are self-medicating, and unfortunately they're having to do it illegally because their condition that they're self-medicating for is not one of the state-recognized qualifying conditions. So I think overall it's fantastic. Each and every condition that gets added, I feel like, is fantastic, because that's someone whose life's being impacted in terms of becoming legal. Because people are going to, you know, find ways. When you have states out there that are recreational, people are going to find ways to be able to medicate themselves. So I think to be able to do it legally is fantastic. So in terms of, as a recommending physician, I think it's fantastic. The more conditions that are appropriate conditions, I think there are more folks that have more peace of mind and are getting safe product, because there, you know, a lot of folks are having to resort to the black market.
What do you know about how the board decides which conditions qualify? This was the first kind of round, 110 proposed conditions. They narrowed it down to, I guess, five or seven or ten at the outset, but then eventually five. They rejected three. They're accepting two: anxiety and autism. What do you make of the process this time around?
I don't know the exact details of that. You know, I try to get to as many of the monthly control program meetings as I can. And I know at one of the meetings they mentioned how they were going to seek the advice of experts, not necessarily in-state, but kind of national experts in those areas to weigh in on those submissions and help them kind of whittle them down. So aside from that, you know, I probably know as much about the process as you do in terms of after the fact, seeing where they, you know, unanimously rejected three and unanimously decided on two. So that's pretty interesting also. So I don't know the details of how that process works.
Some have been critical of the board's decisions about saying that you shouldn't use an addictive substance. That what do we know about the addictiveness of marijuana? Is it, do you think of it as addictive?
I don't think of it as addictive. There's some data out there and kind of some comparison charts. So whenever I give lectures, I use one chart that kind of shows the addictive potential comparable to that Diet Coke that you have every day for lunch.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're talking single digit, 8-9% potential, and that's where, you know, caffeine falls in. When you start looking at things like tobacco, alcohol, and opiates, then you start doing multiples of that. When you start getting into the teens, 25%, 30% addictive potential. So it's a fraction of what are what is being prescribed legally now, like opiates, and it it's just, you know, it's similar to something you could, the addictive potential of something that your kid could get a hold of, like caffeine.
Mary in Columbus, you're on the air with Dr. Joel Simmons. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I wonder if, with the limited research there is, if there are any known conditions, medical conditions a person can have that, well, for which medical marijuana would be contraindicated or a precaution, or are there lists online where you can find such things?
In other words, what not to treat with marijuana.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's it.
All right. Yeah, Dr. Simmons?
That's a huge question. I'm not sure I can answer. That's just such a large question, and that's kind of why we start with what are we most comfortable treating with, as opposed to what should you really stay away from. The controversial areas, I'd say the biggest one right now is with, you know, what about schizophrenia?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what about the family history of schizophrenia? It's kind of a chicken and egg conversation that's being had. There's a is it a correlation or causation between marijuana use and schizophrenia? And if someone has a family history, you know, that's one of the ones I think is a hot topic.
That's because schizophrenia presents typically at an age when kids are starting to smoke pot.
That's right.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
In the early 20s, late teens.
Yeah. But, you know, I'm sure there are plenty of conditions that you would not want to treat with marijuana, which is why we have a list of qualifying conditions. But that's such an open bag there. I'm not going to address.
And another thing about all of this is this isn't going to be an ongoing process. This isn't the end game here, because they're waiting for more research all the time.
Correct. Correct. You know, and you know, we're trained in evidence-based medicine,
mm-hmm.
and unfortunately, this is a situation where, you know, now, you know, medical schools are starting to at least acknowledge the role of the endocannabinoid system. When I went to medical school, graduated in 2002, that was not even a topic. There was not a single lecture. So, you know, and this is where also when you know, it's up to us as physicians to do our own continuing medical education when you're outside of medical school and stay up to date with things. But I also don't fault physicians who are not fully on board, because it isn't something that was taught in medical school. We don't have the true evidence-based research. It's not funded. We're just, you know, we're having to work with what we have, and so I get it. But the one thing I do ask of all physicians when patients are asking about it, because, you know, it's not anything that you can ignore at this point. Patients are asking, is that if you're not comfortable with it and you don't want to address it with your patients, then point them in the right direction of someone who is working with medical marijuana and feels comfortable with it. That's all I ask.
How did you prepare to be a recommending physician in Ohio?
There are some state approved medical education courses that you can take online. I think I wound up taking like 12 or 13 hours worth of education online. They say the state recommends or only requires 2 hours, but there's something up with that. I don't think that's quite the case, because the courses wind up being lengthier than that.
Mm-hmm.
I did choose the most lengthy course out of three that were recommended at the time. But the technically, you need 2 hours of ongoing continuing medical education to, once you receive your certificate, to recommend to keep it up. But because I plan on doing this more full time, I'm probably about 75% of my time in my clinic, Ohio Herbal Clinic. I'm about 75% of my time there now. I kind of go above and beyond. So I'm part of the American Medical Marijuana Physician Association. Mm-hmm. We had a national meeting back in October last year where they brought in national speakers. I just went to a Patients Out of Time meeting about a month ago. Dr. Sue Sicily was there and gave an amazing lecture. They had a video lecture by Dr. Rafael Machulam, who's the founder, who discovered THC. So I am continuously trying to educate myself because of my interest in it. But the minimum requirement from the state is just 2 hours.
Well, Dr. Joel Simmons, thanks again for joining us. I always appreciate your insights.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me anytime.
Dr. Joel Simmons is a radiation oncologist in Columbus and a medical marijuana recommending physician in Ohio. We'll have a link to his website at ours at WOSU.org/allsides. More Wellness Wednesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
WOSU Public Media's newest podcast series, Rivet, young people share their unique pathways to professional success. Listen to This American Graduate Project. Find Rivet now in WOSU's mobile app or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. A new study out of Tufts University found that consuming vegetables as part of a regular daily diet may be better than taking dietary supplements. Dr. Fangfang Zhang is an associate professor of epidemiology at Tufts University and co-author of the study. We'll post a link to it on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Dr. Zhang joins us now by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. My pleasure to be here.
Why have dietary supplements, including daily vitamins, become so controversial?
Well, first of all, it's that a prevalent use among U.S. adult population. Over half of the U.S. adult population use dietary supplements. But when we look at the evidence, whether supplement use is associated with benefits or risks remains controversial. The overall evidence seems to suggest no benefit or harms, but there are a few randomized controlled trials have reported adverse outcomes. So we wanted to study this further using the what we called the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, which is a large survey that recruited national representative U.S. adult population.
So the takeaway from the study was that eating your vegetables the normal way is the best way to get your vitamins and minerals that some people are trying to get from supplements. Did you find any adverse outcomes to using the supplements?
Right. First is that we didn't find use of dietary supplements was related to mortality benefits, meaning that they're not related to reduced risk of death among U.S. adult population. Then we did find adequate intake of certain nutrients is related to reduced risk of all-cause mortality when the nutrient is consumed from foods, but not supplements.
Okay.
And then the last point is go to what you ask is there were some suggestions that excessive intake of some nutrients from supplements could have untoward effects.
Taking too much.
Right. So more is not necessarily better when the form is from the supplement form.
We often lump the term vitamin, supplement, and mineral together and that kind of a thing. Is there a distinction that's important to know about?
Distinction for what?
Between vitamins and minerals and supplements.
We looked at different types of vitamins, minerals individually.
Okay.
So I don't think we tried to distinguish between among them.
Okay.
But the one that we found is that some nutrients that are related to our reduced risk of all-cause mortality, meaning having some benefits effect, those are vitamin A, vitamin K, magnesium, zinc, and copper. However, these are only from foods, not from supplements. And one thing I also want to add to that is when we say, well, these five nutrients seem to have are beneficial effect for reducing mortality, it is hard to say this is the individual nutrient that played a role, because we eat foods, not nutrients in isolation.
Mm-hmm.
So there are complex interactions among multiple nutrients from foods. So these nutrients, well, when they have a beneficial effect, they may reflect the interaction among multiple nutrients from healthy foods, such as vegetables and fruits.
You mean like the idea that when I eat broccoli, I'm not just getting nutrients, I'm also getting fiber and that kind of a thing?
Exactly, yeah. So we're eating the whole foods rather than our nutrient per se.
What kinds of vegetables? Tell me how you did your study. What kind of vegetables do people eat, and how did you conduct the study?
Right. So this study was conducted by, I think it's by CDC. It's the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey. So how the dietary data was assessed is there are people who are trained interviewers, then ask study participants what they ate during the past 24 hours, including all the foods and beverage they consume. And some people provided 2 days of what we call diet recall. And in that sense, the 2 days consumption was averaged. So those nutrients were estimated from all the reported foods and beverages reported by each participant that participated in that study.
And then you compared that with people who reported taking supplements.
Supplements, yeah. Right. So this study, I think it's our advantage of this, and what we call NHANES, the National Health Nutrition Examination Survey, because it asks questions for both foods that we consume from our diet, but also the supplement use in the past 30 days. So we were able to evaluate the total nutrient intake that is combined from both foods and supplements, and we were also able to look at them separately, whether the nutrient source is from foods versus nutrient source from supplements. And indeed, as we just spoke, that there were differences we found. So we are not the only study that found that there could be different potential effects that for the same nutrients, whether it's from food versus supplements. I think that's our important things that we should look further, that different source that from the nutrients may potentially have different health effects.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about a study out of Tufts University that found that consuming vegetables as part of a regular daily diet may be better than taking dietary supplements. My guest is Dr. Fengfeng Zhang. She's an associate professor of epidemiology at Tufts and co-author of the study. We're going to have a post a link to it on our website at wosu.org/allsides. If you have a question for Dr. Zhang, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Did it matter at all the types of foods people were eating? Were you able to suss that out?
No, for this study, we only looked at nutrients. So the nutrients would come from all different types of foods. We didn't intend to look at different type of foods who may contribute the same nutrient.
So we aren't necessarily talking about vegetables then?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah,
okay.
I would just about say that. It's the nutrients from all foods.
All foods, okay. And what there, you know, usually it's because, well, I don't know why people take them. I don't take any supplements, but people take supplements because they don't get enough of something, because maybe they don't like citrus or maybe they don't like broccoli or whatever. So they think that they're going to take a vitamin. What are some of the key nutrients that people tend to look for in supplements?
Right. I think there are more questions that ask in a survey, why do you use supplements? Then the top reasons that the participants answered were to improve health, to maintain health, and to supplement their diets. So people may have various reasons trying to use supplements, and the people with chronic health conditions are found to be more likely to use dietary supplements than the others. So the dietary supplement use are look at individual nutrients. The prevalence are different based on what kind of nutrients they were taking. So when we look at them by individually, that the nutrients that used more frequently than the others for in terms of supplements, including vitamin C, vitamin D, vitamin E, those are for the vitamins, and for minerals, those were calcium and zinc and magnesium.
Are there some people who should use supplements because they can't consume the foods that contain the nutrients in a regular diet?
Right, that's a very good question. You know, so this sample is the U.S. general population. So this sample, this study population does not oversample. People may have chronic health conditions that prevent them mm-hmm. from absorbing enough nutrients from foods. So I think that our study findings cannot be applied to that populations may actually need additional supplement. Those could be, as mentioned, that people have GI gastrointestinal issues that they cannot absorb nutrients from foods adequately, mm-hmm. Including elderly. And we know that for pregnant women that their dietary intake folate is different from the rest of the population. And also for people who may have specific dietary practice, such as vegetarians, and they may be deficient in nutrients, certain nutrients that they actually would need dietary supplements. So I think that we have to be careful looking at our findings that this is for the U.S. general population. Mm-hmm. And for specific groups, whether there will be benefit from nutrition supplements, that's not going to be, it's not what we studied, but I think it's important that who use dietary supplements should talk to their doctor about the supplement use. Because certain populations, they may not be appropriate to using supplements. So it's important that this discussion can occur between any of us with our primary care physicians. Another evaluation we did, we haven't published, is a large proportion of the U.S. population, they use dietary supplements without letting their doctor know.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. When I'm asked, do I use any, I say no. They go, oh, that makes things a lot simpler. And then is there a way, can you refer people to a way to know if you're getting enough nutrients from your food? Is there a way to figure that out?
Right, yeah. So for certain nutrients that we actually looked at it because there is a biomarker can indicate the status of certain nutrients, such as vitamin D. So in our study, we were able to see among those people who with signs of nutrition deficiency, vitamin D deficiency versus those not, then mm-hmm. you can actually look at that. But the problem is not all the nutrients would have a biomarker. So for some nutrients, we may not be able to tell whether you have adequate versus not intake. We can assess them from our diet, right, just like the enhanced survey has done is to ask what people to recall what they have ate in the past 24 hours and then trying to average, summarize the data. But this method also has some limitations because there are some, we call it measurement error associated with this assessment because we depend on people recall what they eat. So I think that there are no perfect way to know for a standard way for all nutrients. I think it will be depending on that specific nutrient that will be evaluated. For some nutrients that have good biomarker, then we can test them, draw blood, and evaluate them. For mm-hmm. for other nutrients that if there's no good biomarkers, then we can use the dietary recall data to give some ideas that what are individual in people's intake at individual level and then compare that to the dietary reference intake. So to have some ideas whether for individual, whether this person's dietary intake is below or consistent or above the recommended intake.
Well, Dr. Zhang, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time today.
You're welcome. My pleasure to be here.
That's Dr. Fengfeng Zhang. She's an associate professor of epidemiology at Tufts University and co-author of a new study out of Tufts that found that eating a regular diet is maybe better than taking dietary supplements when it comes to getting nutrients. More Wellness Wednesday is coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Run the hill, jump the tires, climb the wall. Hundreds of competitors descended on the Delaware County Fairgrounds last weekend for the Rugged Maniac Race, one of a growing number of obstacle course competitions across the country. Tis the season again, so we invited Central Ohio fitness instructor Chris Zabo to train, who has trained competitors to both survive and enjoy obstacle course races. She joins us now. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Anne. It's great to be here again.
Listeners, have you signed up for or completed an obstacle course race? How did you train for it? Let us know. And if you have any questions, call us at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I've completed a few of them in my day, and I was no competition, that's for sure. But if it's something to be proud of, I think, when you do it, even if you walk the whole course, like I saw a lot of people doing one time, it's still cool. What do you think the benefits are, Chris Zabo, of the obstacle course thing?
Well, I think part of the rage of all the obstacle courses and training for them is really, I mean, it gives people something different to do. I come from a running background, so that also attracts quite a few people. But then there's this new thing that there's all these different sorts of challenges. And I think the other part that really adults pile onto is there's a sense of teamwork and community, which
it's
can
usually
be
teams that go or groups.
Yeah. So, you know, whether it's a corporate team or, you know, I put together teams to go and compete, you get to train together. And so there's this level of like doing hard things, not just by yourself, but with others. And I just think that makes it just more special and memorable and something to be proud of.
There's also a sense of more physically fit, not just as for running, but for you have to have the upper body strength. You have to have a lot of different things going on.
You do. So, you know, I mean, we can talk about this, but training for that stuff, and you know, but you can just go run or whatnot, but
I've seen a few people just kind of slog their way through it.
Yeah. And then it's just like an eye opener, you know what I mean? So, it's fun to be creative with the training. I found that as an instructor and both as a competitor, if you will. So that was really fun. And, it keeps people engaged, I think. And, yeah, you have to have a little bit of everything. So you can't just be like a straight runner, and you can't just be somebody that can lift a lot of weight, and you have to be all those things, you know, strong. You have to have perseverance. You have to be mentally tough for sure, and depending on the race, right? And then you have to be agile. So something we're all trying to, you know, preserve in our aging.
What is your advice for people who have never done an obstacle course race before as far as how to pick the right first one to do?
That's a good question. I think my first tip would be to start out slowly. So if somebody has never done anything, let's say they've just never even done a lot of physical activity, you have to start in baby steps, just like everything, you know. So I would start with walking. I would start with some running, something more on a pure level, and then you can add in like strength in the routine, and then from there you can start to mix it up, and then also then start adding, you know, creative obstacles or different kinds of activities from that. But you have to have those sort of baseline things to build on, and then also I think it's really important to have a group to train with, because particularly when you're starting from ground zero, it's really hard.
And when you're ending up in a mud pit at the very end, it's nice to have
with electrical wire, yeah,
who will speak to you. You don't frighten,
right?
The one thing I liked about obstacle course runs was that they're outside and you're going through woods and stuff like that. I really loved that aspect of it.
Yeah, I mean, actually, we didn't touch on that earlier. That's one of the huge attractions to me as well, because in my career of coaching, I've actually tried to stay out of the gym as much as possible and train people in natural environments. So it's something that they can adapt to. You know, they don't have to buy some fancy equipment or something to stay in shape. And, mm-hmm. you know, there's this misperception that you need a gym membership to be in shape, and you absolutely don't. And because the large majority of Americans have jobs, a lot of us have jobs inside, it's really nice to go and train and do something outside. Mm-hmm. Then, you know, there's so much research that shows, you know, to help you with mental acuity and mm-hmm. depression and anxiety. So Yeah, and I love that too. And I think that's why it appeals to a lot of people too, is you can be outside and, you know, Mother Nature will throw at her, you know, whatever she wants.
Oh, and I'd love to talk about the race where it was snowing. Folks, we're talking about the obstacle course races. If you have a question or comment about them, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. My guest is Chris Sabo. She's a Central Ohio fitness instructor. We've talked with her before about these kinds of fitness questions, so she can maybe answer yours. Again, 614-292-8513. Yeah, you did. Was it the Tough Mudder?
Well, actually, so we started back in the day, we did the Warrior Dash.
Well, the Warrior Dash, like, but the one where 5K. It was like...
We did the Spartan. So we did the Tough Mudder as well.
Horrible. Yeah.
So what we did is we did, we did the Warrior Dash with a group of people and had a great time and thought, well, let's up the ante and let's all train for something
harder.
And Ann
dropped out, yeah.
What'd you say?
I dropped out.
And then Ann was done, which is totally fine. So then we decided to do the Spartan, which was the real tough one was the Spartan Super, which they had advertised as an 8-plus obstacle course race. Mm-hmm. So we trained... trained everybody for something like 8.5, maybe 8.6. And it ended up being closer to, I want to say, 14 miles. And Mother Nature threw a lot at us. I mean, truly, we were on the verge of hypothermia at the end of that race. It was quite a bonding experience. If you talk to anybody, as you know, the Worthington Warriors, they will tell you that it was kind of a defining experience, I think, for all of us, including me. We did that, and then we wanted to come back for more. We did the Spartan Beast because we're like, well, if we did that, we can do the 16-mile one. So we did that, and then we did do the Tough Mudder, I think, in between.
Mm-hmm.
They were fun, and it's fun to do them while your body can handle it, and it's a great experience to have with others.
Climbing hills is a problem in Central Ohio because there aren't a lot of hills, so you've got to go find them. And
yes.
One of the places I trained, and I'm not sure it was with you or not, was out at the dam.
Mm-hmm.
The
Hoover Dam.
Yeah, because there's those steps that you can go up and down, and you just can't find something like that just about anywhere.
So that's a great training place. I don't think we did that in the Warrior Dash training, but we did do it for Spartan. We would go out there. I know a lot of trainers take groups out there to do some training. That's a great, great venue. I love High Banks. It's my favorite metro park for many reasons, and they have wonderful hills. The other one that I love is Worthington Hills and the little community. I mean, I grew up there, and I have a lot of memories of those hills, and I thought I'd bring some memories to other
people. Just that first hill.
Yeah,
alone.
Yeah. Yep, that hill, there's maybe like two. There's a couple more in there, but that one's the best.
And what about running on the uneven ground and running through woods and that kind of a thing? It amazed me when I've been on them before that more people weren't tripping and falling and that kind of a thing. But I suppose if I could do it, anybody could. But but what about that?
Well, I mean, I think it's beneficial to run on trails or run on uneven surfaces besides asphalt. I mean, asphalt is not good on your body over long periods of time anyway because of, it's very, it's hard on the joints and whatnot. So anytime you can get on a trail would be great. And really, you might be a little sore in the ankles in the beginning, a lot of people, but you do build up muscles by doing it. It's the same thing. We do some training on BOSU balls indoors, and training on that because it's unstable helps, just like physical therapy. People use that as well to bring back from injury.
Does the gear change at all?
Are you asking about
my gear
uphills?
Would change in so much? I'm changing just generally running out.
Okay.
Gear changes in so much as I want to wear stuff that I will be happy to dispose of afterward.
I mean, it depends on. Of course, you don't always know what the weather is going to do. So let's go back to October of 2014 when we did the Super, and, everybody wore as minimal amount of clothing as possible because you're going to get really wet and you don't want to wear cotton. That's number one.
Slogging through.
Don't want to wear cotton because it's just going to absorb and hang on your body and get cold and create really bad situation for yourself. So that was number one. And then I think it depending on the time of year to wear gloves. Also, it's good to wear some sort of disposable glove. Like we all bought those kind of garden gloves because they were real, real cheap and then you could throw them away. but you have something that kind of can like stick. So if you're pulling a rope or you're pulling yourself up on something, you've got that for
like
grip.
Like the rubberized garden gloves?
Yeah, it's like rubber on one side.
Yeah.
And those were really good. I mean, those got really wet and it got really cold. But and then maybe a hat, but not really because that falls off. And,
right.
You know, so really no cotton, no pants, maybe tights.
Do you have a sense about how they run those races and what makes a good race? what to look for a good race as far as how they manage them?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. Because we did do different ones by different organizations, we got kind of a good sense of who runs a good one. I think, you know, it's logistics have to be really well thought out from the race director standpoint. One of the races, which I don't know if I necessarily need to throw somebody under the bus on the air, one of the races, you know, their systems went down and they didn't have a backup. And then, you know, it's just all these lines and people, you know, it's crazy. The other one I will say, I will say this about the Spartan Series is I don't think they do it anymore in October because it became a liability. Yeah. And, you know, the weather's just, it's just too unpredictable. And I don't think they were prepared for that. And I absolutely know it because we brought our own blankets and whatnot. But if we didn't, I mean, there was like a tiny fire, smoldering fire for everybody to gather around. So,
You can get pretty dirty.
Yeah, you get very dirty.
Mud pits are a big
cesspool.
Of the mud pits are they're gross.
They're gross, and you really don't want to think about it. And let's be very clear: you sign a waiver,
a death waiver,
before you go and do any of these races, because you don't want to. I mean, you know, reading it verbatim is terrifying, but that's how they have to cover themselves for sure.
There was something we did when we were training where we were walking on a log and you slipped and ended up having surgery years later because of it.
Yes,
so
I did.
So you got to be careful.
You do. And obstacle course races, I would say there's a lot more risk involved than, say, a road race, you know, because of all the unpredictability you've got. So, yeah, I mean, we trained at the Audubon, and there's a balance beam. It's raised, and we all went out there, and I don't regret doing that because we were going to have to train for it. But, yeah, in all my years of being physical, I mean, I took a huge spill and just sprained it. I was like, wow, that was bad. And then a couple years later, every time I would
really
run.
It was bad.
It was pretty bad. And then every time I would run, I felt like it would swell, and I'm like, this is – do I just have a bum ankle now, or, you know, am I just getting old and this is just how it's going to go? Or so then I had it checked out and he was like, you know, whatever, it was complete acutely torn. And then it tried to heal on its own, which was not working well. So yes, I had reconstructive ankle surgery and I can run and all that, but, I don't think I'm going to do any more obstacle course races, but that doesn't mean I don't think they're awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't. You know, I'm not 25 either, so.
Well, I remember at my age when I went out once and there was only three or four people in my age group and I was the only female. And I'm like, I've already won this race.
Like, I am a winner.
I can just finish it. I'm the best female in my group. Let's see. Maggie and Sunbury are on the air. Hi, Maggie.
Hi. My question is, I have a grandson who's graduating this year and is going to the OSU Newark campus. And he's always been involved in sports, football, lacrosse, and had this team experience. And although he's saying he's going to go to a gym when he gets out of high school, I think this would be a great thing for him if he could find a team to join. I think it's hard for a teenager to say, well, I'll get a team together. And can you give me any advice about that?
Yeah.
Yeah. So thanks for calling in. That's a great question. And it does drive home the point of you get a lot of, you know, it's your son or your grandson, excuse me, going away, has this great team experience. And then all of a sudden, you know, people are left to work out on their own or join a class. And there's not kind of a lot of, you know, soul left. So I would encourage him, I guess, to either take charge and create a team. Or if he's got like he's going to college. So if he has like classmates or friends and then create a team that way, I think that that's one of the best ways to do it.
I was going to say, what about just getting a trainer, somebody that can lead a group so you can, you know, everyone can chip in for a trainer and maybe once a week and have someone do it that way.
Yeah, that would be a great way. So even if he went to a gym and got a gym membership, find a trainer and maybe find a trainer that's a little bit, I would say a little offbeat because, I don't know, you want somebody that can think outside the box. I think that's fun. And then they will help with, you know, organizing that and getting him on board. So hopefully that helps.
Yeah, Maggie, that was a nice question. That is a thing, too, that these kids grow up and all the way through school and then they're done. And what do they do then? They're not used to working out by themselves. And
I do really think that that was the appeal of a lot of these obstacle course races, because if you think about, there's a lot of particularly like midlifers that, you know, are kind of like, hey, you know, I used to be in shape. I used to do all these things. I'm super busy. I feel kind of isolated. And so they can go and do a gym membership or they could take a class, but it's not the same as having, if you look at like CrossFit or, you know, we had a group, the Worthington Warriors, we did a lot together. Mm-hmm. And I would say, probably not putting words to people, but it was a special experience. And it was because we were a team and because, you know, it just raises you up with that kind of experience.
What, you know, another thing we haven't talked about is the issue of hydration, and this goes to the event planners and how they manage the race, particularly when you're talking about anything over 3 miles is going to be something you're going to be hydrating, and you're not just running 3 miles, you're doing obstacle course as well.
Yeah. I think I've blacked out, like, just kidding.
I remember, it was 90 degrees out one day, and I got the chills for a phatathlon out in Marysville, and that was, I was just not getting enough fluid, and I wasn't prepared to figure out how to get it.
Yeah, I mean, it is on generally the race and the director and the logistics, you know, to make sure that they have sufficient water stops throughout.
It's something to ask about and look for.
Yes, it is.
Before you sign up.
And I would say, you know, in a 5K, I really don't think you need a lot of water. To be honest, you can get through that and you're going to be okay unless, you know, it's 100 degrees.
Right.
After that, there should be something every couple miles. I do think that Spartan, they didn't have like any water. So when you're doing an obstacle course race, well, Ragnar too is another like trail run that we've done. A lot of people will wear like water hydration packs on their back, like
a backpack.
But
they're not jumping over
obstacles.
But
they're not wading through water.
Right.
So in a like a Spartan event, there needs to be water stops.
What is the best obstacle that you can ever remember?
Oh, you know what? It was the best and like the most terrifying, I think, was there was, I think it was in the Tough Mudder, actually. We had to go way up on top of a, I don't know, a platform.
Yeah.
And we had to do a Tarzan swing across. I mean, it was high and across this water and, you know, it was terrifying. You got up there and it was kind of scary.
Were people
and then,
dropping like flies?
Yeah, I mean, I think I definitely dropped. I don't think I made it. Gosh, my memory's really
that
bad.
That would be scary.
But anyway, you know, that was kind of scary. Another one that I do think the best obstacles are the ones that are both scary and exhilarating, right? So it kind of has to push you somewhere to be cool.
I like the climbing ones.
Yeah, like the nets and...
Yeah. I don't know why, because I'm afraid of heights, but not super, but they were still fun.
Yeah, those are fun. It would be fun to, anybody want to call in if you've done one and you want to tell.
Now.
Is it
too
late?
It's too late if you want to
call. Don't
call
us.
We're out of time.
Yeah, I was just curious like what people's favorites are.
Yeah,
it's across the board.
Well, Chris Sabo, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, no problem. Love to be here. Thanks.
Chris Sabo, Central Ohio Fitness Instructor. We've been talking about obstacle courses. 'Tis the season in Ohio. If you want to post something on Facebook, please do. Go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page and post your favorite obstacle. And thanks for listening today. This has been All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.